Hello friends, hello folks. Great to make a return on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. My name is Seifumi Adebote. I am your green guide on this ride. Welcome to this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. I would like to thank you indeed for joining me on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. If you're joining for the first time, I'm wondering, where on the planet have you been? But regardless of where you've been, I hope you've been keeping safe in these very unusual times that the world is battling COVID-19, coronavirus, and the impact that it has, not just on the climate, but more importantly, on lives of people. With 16 million people affected by this virus, it's indeed a disaster. And my guest calls it a sister disaster to climate change. You know who my guest is in a bit. But very quickly, I want to say thank you to all those who have subscribed to the Climate Talk podcast, over 10,000 listeners every month. That means a lot to me and to my team. For those who are yet to subscribe, it is www.climatetalkpodcast.com. I'll take it again, www.climatetalkpodcast.com. Right there, you'll find the subscribe icon. Feel free to subscribe. You can also subscribe from every other app or website where you listen to podcasts. The Climate Talk podcast is on virtually every platform that hosts podcasts, from iTunes to Google Podcasts to Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio, CastBox, Anchor. You will find the Climate Talk podcast there. So feel free to subscribe and be a part of these very engaging conversations that I have. Pretty much what I do on the Climate Talk podcast is to have conversations with thought leaders, politicians, policymakers, youth activists, advocates, and different people who play different roles along this long value chain of climate change and climate action as we have it. And it is always very exciting for me. I will tell you the truth. There is no episode where I do not learn something new. And this is why I encourage you to be a part of the Climate Talk podcast family, so that together we can grow and, more importantly, we can take actions to protect the planet. Now that you know what we do on the Climate Talk podcast, if you have something interesting related to climate change or environmental issues and you'd like me to spotlight it on the Climate Talk podcast, feel free to reach out to me. My email is shei@climatetalkpodcast.com. That is SEYI@climatetalkpodcast.com. I'm not alone on this ship. I've got my two co-pilots with me, Olumide Idowu and Jimo Oluwatobisegun. These two make it very possible for you to listen to new episodes of the Climate Talk podcast every month. Make yourself comfortable as we dive into the conversation on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. My guest on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast is from the southern part of Africa. You're wondering, where exactly? Namibia, that's the country. He is one of the most versatile and well-experienced young persons on the African continent when it comes to climate change, policies, and innovations. I am so excited that we found the time to make this episode. His name is Dion Shekuza. But just before I get into this conversation with Dion, if you missed the last episode of the Climate Talk podcast, you really want to check it out. I had a conversation with Matthew Leffler. Matthew's organization has mobilized over 1 billion people across the world to take actions for the environment. And you're wondering, 1 billion? Yes, exactly. The Earth Day Network has mobilized over 1 billion people since inception to take action for the environment. They celebrated their 50th anniversary last month, and I had this chat with Matthew Leffler, who is the African coordinator, and he told me about how they've been maximizing this digital switch from being on the ground and advocating for issues to dominating the social media, or the media as it were, and to continue driving that message among young people, among policymakers, about the need to protect our planet. Feel free to check out that episode on every platform where you get the podcast. And remember, if you subscribe, you become one of our over 5,000 listeners who listen to the Climate Talk podcast every month. Very quickly, I want to say thank you to you for listening. And I also want to say congratulations to three of my colleagues who made the 7-man youth advisory group that the United Nations Secretary General recently launched. Congratulations, Paloma Costa from Brazil, Nisrin El-Saim from Sudan, representing Africa, and Vladislav. Vlad, forgive me if I missed your name, all the way from Moldova. By the way, Paloma and Nisrin have been on this podcast in previous episodes, so feel free to check out the chat I had with them. Enough talk. Let's get into this conversation with Dion Shikuza. On this episode of the Climate Talk podcast, my guest is a friend and a colleague, someone I respect so much. His name is Dion Shikuza. Did I pronounce that right?
Correct. Affirmative.
Absolutely. Dion is from Namibia and he does really, really amazing work around the SDGs, around sustainable development, and particularly around climate action and the involvement of young people. Dion, how would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, first and foremost, for having me. I choose to identify as a youth advocate working on issues of sustainable development, in particular focusing on climate change and renewable energy. Looking at the engagement, participation, and advocacy of young people within these sectors as a whole. So I'm part at the national level, I'm very active at the regional level and also at the international level. I form part of different civil youth groups that are advancing the cause of young people and climate change. And probably as we discuss, I'll share a little bit more about those particular networks in relation to the topic at hand.
Absolutely. I'm very curious to know about some of the practical works you do on the field in Namibia. I know you work around the solar system, you work around farming and agriculture processes. I really would love to know all of that. But just so the listener out there can understand, this is a conversation that we'll be having and we'll be touching on different things, one of which is going to be COVID-19, of course, and what's been the impact on climate change, what's been the reflections and the metrics that is in place for climate action. We'll also be looking at COP25. We all left COP25 in Spain. You remember you and I were there. And we came back to our countries with so much excitement and drive to deliver on the decade of action for the SDGs and also on climate action itself. 2020 has been a very interesting year. There was a calendar we had discussed earlier this year and we felt this year to actually deliver on those things. But with the whole COVID-19 and how we changed the entire narrative, it's like things have just gone down the drain. And the most recent is the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on climate change. Everyone is talking about this. This just happened. And then it's also something I would love to know your thoughts about. So these are the thoughts that Dion and I will be sharing on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. And I am very, very excited to have you, Dion. Welcome again. So let's start with Namibia. What are some of the practical climate solutions that are driven by young people in Namibia today?
Very brief question. Perhaps just with a slight country profile in order to understand like the vulnerabilities of the country in terms of climate change. To start with, Namibia would be sitting in it's basically a southern hemisphere country, as we know. And within Africa as a continent, Namibia's environmental agenda is basically one of the most advanced when it comes to constitutional law, and it comes to community engagement. However, the challenge with that is that the country is a post-apartheid state, and that means a lot of inequalities and disparities still exist, which toughens the job for government to actually take charge on the climate change agenda. That means majority of the Namibians, we acknowledge our vulnerabilities to climate change, but majority are first trying to fix the basics, and that's why you would see things like unemployment, access to land. Even just access to land is a problem for Namibians. That's why it's difficult for you to take care of a piece of land that you don't even own, especially if that land is privatized and the law protects it. Namibia is also considered the driest country south of the Sahara Desert. And that gives us an average of 0 to 5 meters of water that we would probably get within the desert, and the highest amount of rainfall we would receive would be on the east side of the country, which is closer to the Okavango Delta, because we have two deserts. We've got the Namib on the west coast side, which is where we have the least amount of precipitation, and then we've got the Kalahari Desert as well, which is sitting on our east. And so that means we are sandwiched in between the in terms of any particular land we could really use. And as in specific to your question now, some of the solutions young people are advancing. For us as the youth here in Namibia, we very much interested in public engagement, awareness raising, education, and basically small scale projects that young people undertake themselves, like small gardening, small irrigation projects. And you find that most of them are in a rural setting that are adapting themselves. In terms of a broader project at a national level, I would rather say we have been working more in silos. We haven't yet reached a point where we are institutionally integrated in order to know that you can have a long-term plan for your actions. Because one thing about climate action is sustainability of those actions. It doesn't matter what you do now, it's really what you keep doing consistently in order to achieve the results. So far, in terms of small-scale projects, I've seen young Namibians advancing their own solutions, whether it's water and sanitation issues, where you find young people coming up with solutions of converting salt water into potable and drinking water, or you find others working on waterless toilets. Because remember, climate change for us has to be linked to our problems. So we can't really go on a massive tree planting campaign unless it also links to, let me say, community conservation. That's why in Namibia you'd find we have one of the best examples of community sustainable development initiatives in the world, which is basically the community-based natural resource management program that looks into conserving and preserving natural resources, in particular nature-based resources like wildlife. And then you work with the community, and somehow the concessions from all the proceedings and financial benefits go to the community. So at the local level, you find a lot of such projects. But if you come then to the urban side of town, we also are not too, we are maybe then looking into issues like energy, where you see young people focusing on solar, whether they are collecting solar jars or creating their own and distributing to those living in informal settlements in order to bring access to energy and reduce indoor pollution based on biomass, wood cooking stoves and stuff like that. So I would rather say there's a mix of all, and highlighting particular solution above the other, I wouldn't be too comfortable with doing that. I'd rather say that we have a various amount of different youth agendas working on climate.
This is one very interesting thing that I think we need to push out a lot more. The fact that the problems that the changing climate poses to Nigeria is completely different from what it poses to the US. It's different from what it poses to you down there in Namibia. Sure, within West Africa, the challenges that Ghana as a country experiences is different from what Cameroon experiences. And so in achieving or in driving the solutions, it has to be in context. We don't just come up with a map and say, this is the way to address climate change. It has to be in context. Let me take you to September 2019. We were in the United States, New York, where the Secretary General had launched a climate action summit. That was the first of its kind. And it's been a process. You and I were also in the United Arab Emirates, midway, June, July 2019, where we had begun all of the process and began to engage world leaders as to how young people could drive youth mobilization and engagement to achieve climate action. Many countries made commitment during this climate action summit, including Nigeria, where our president promised to plant 25 million trees. I knew many other countries. I was in the all day, and I heard many other countries also make their commitments. And then all the way to COP25 in Spain, you know, there was a lot of back and forth, and then eventually it was able to hold, and we were excited about that. And we were in the room again, and we saw all the old deliberations and the conversations here and there. And we left all of this place. I mean, we came out of 2019 into 2020 with a drive that this was going to be sort of a launch to deliver on the SDGs and sort of decade of action. With what 2020 as a year has presented us right now, the first half of the year is gone, and see where we are. What do you make of all this?
I think that's a very important question when it comes to stock taking in terms of climate action. I would rather say that most of the conferences that we had attended in the last years that you mentioned were very much specifically looking at raising ambition. In particular, given that when we aggregated the NDCs, obviously through the UNFCCC process, it was clear that we are not even reaching the benchmark of halting the warming further to 1.5 or alternatively 2 degrees Celsius. And we realized even when all the NDCs are put together, we still are not anywhere near there, but rather much further. So I think the appetite to bring stakeholders together at a high level was what drove this. Because before we go to the, to the Climate Action Summit or the Preparatory Action Summit in Abu Dhabi, there were other events like the political forums, if I can call it that. And these forums were actually supposed to undertake and advance these causes. But you would realize that in 2020, obviously the scapegoat would be Corona, obviously, you know, many guys are going to feel like Corona has... Yeah, it's definitely a scapegoat now for anyone who doesn't want to raise their ambition. But I have seen a couple of countries actually go further. We've seen countries like, Rwanda would also be the first one in Africa to submit their NDC, quite ambitious. And you would see like less than 7 countries basically meet the targets of what net zero contributions should look like. But in specific, what I think about the whole process since the commitments we made in 2019 and the actions we've seen in 2020, I would say that we're not doing what we're supposed to do as a global community.
Have we really seen actions in 2020?
That's what I'm saying. In 2020, apart from, if we remove the concept of Corona and the pandemic, you would find that we haven't really seen much happening because the whole system came to a halt. But I believe when that was the chance then for us as the climate action community to take charge, because now we've seen the more important factors in our communities at that time were things like agriculture. We have seen reports by the SADC, the Southern African Development Community, which show that at least up to 40 million people in SADC are food insecure in 2020 data and statistics that they've carried out. And you could see that during the 2020 first half of the year, one thing that I would have liked to see that did not require on-ground action or bringing people together, anything that was going to contradict the safety measures that were enacted by the World Health Organization, is finances. Because finances is still the biggest stone for us when it comes to climate action. And if you look at the Green Climate Fund, because it's good you are linking 2020, the Green Climate Fund had set a target that by 2020, it will have at least $100 billion annually put in the fund. And yet that fund still hasn't seen even up to $30 billion directly sitting in it. And we are now relying on small donation, philanthropic donations, charity. I mean, it's nice. We support that. However, we want a commitment that sticks to what has been agreed upon in the text of the negotiations.
That was the agreement in Copenhagen.
It would later be followed through the whole Durban process all the way to when we got to Paris and eventually COP22. It's like the commitments were there, but the finances are not flowing yet. Then two is basically also looking at the technical capacity of governments. Because remember, the climate action agenda when it comes to developing nations is that it's about priority. Most of these small nations are forced to choose drought irrigation project, and then they probably have to cost an opportunity to further develop a social, like their hospitals or their education and something else. It seems that for me, I very much am worried that our ambition, while we're focusing on raising ambition, because we did a good job, that's why you saw so many commitments in 2019. The ambition was actually high. Many states were inspired. In fact, we had the biggest climate strike in the same month. In New York, globally, yes. UN there would also participate in that. And the feeling during the UN General Assembly, even the leader of the United States was also part of that, you know? And so we felt like things are not that bad. Things are moving.
Especially, you know, live and appreciating the roles of young people too, you know?
Yeah, and that's the one I wanted to come to, because 2020 was supposed to be a year of action, especially for young people. 2019 was the time that the young people were brought to the highest of the authority figures to speak. That's why you'd even see when we went to COP25 in Spain, Santiago, in Spain, from Chile, when we went to Spain, you found that the young people were also very proactive during the COP meetings. We've had also the biggest strike happening at the UNFCCC, which was largely dominated by the youth group, and some of us had to renegotiate for them to come back into the COP, given that they broke the rules. But answering your question, I would say finances was the first one. I haven't seen finances increasing. I've rather much just seen replenishment of financial institutions, meaning we stick to the same target amount. We replenish that same target amount with maybe a little few extra millions here and there, but it's not reaching the target that was agreed upon. Because you as a young person, how are you going to benefit from climate finances if these finances are still at the same level? That means the institutions at play, which were always benefiting from them, would continue to get benefit. Because I mentioned earlier that it's not just about projects, it's about consistency, longevity, and sustainability, so that your project continues to go on and on. And you saw with COVID-19, a lot of projects probably came to a stop and were halted due to the fact that money was now not available, or rather it was being redirected for more prominent livelihood-based agendas, like making sure nobody dies and we have less casualties, and our economies are resuscitated to be back to basic functions. So I would say that I haven't seen too much happening. Maybe perhaps we have not seen that communication done, because at the local level, I'm sure climate action has to happen. Because remember, for people on the ground, it's not about which year it is, it's like it's survival mode, and you have to be out there working your land or trying to find alternative water sources or trying to ensure that you are having some adaptation support for your farming and other activities that you do.
Yeah, let me pick you up on this. So as a young person, I mean, I've been on the scene for over 5 years, actively participating in all these climate conversations, and then also some on the ground advocacy, right, and solutions. But I think, I mean, one of the things that drives me crazy is the fact that people think young people's role is just to do advocacy, just to talk about this thing, just to carry placards and tweet about these things. They don't believe that young people could drive ideas, that we have some really very fantastic ideas, and that if these ideas are funded and scaled up, it could be the magic that countries need to really drive and work with that climate ambition. So I'm wondering, how can we change, how can we get these people to know that, see, give young people the chance not just to advocate, but to also bring solutions to the table and fund those ideas. In relation to what you just said, how exactly can we change that narrative?
I'm happy that you asked that question, because if you focus on the content I've been sharing so far, I've really been coming from a youth angle, because that's the angle in which I actually take a lot. And I feel like that's the angle that's also least listened to and least understood. So asking then, how we can get governments to realize what's more to young people than just telling us, no, you need to be on the streets, make a noise. I mean, that's fine. It should be accompanied, however, and complemented by an alternative process that follows the striking. So when you go to the streets, you are striking because you know what's on the ground or what's the deficit on the ground. And therefore, when you take it to the state institutions, you're arguing from, this is happening, we acknowledge that, but you're missing out on this.
And then you present solutions. I mean, that way, the fact that you understand what is happening on the ground, how it's affecting people, you can also think around some solutions. You're not just going into the room to complain, but you're also going to present solutions that they can take on. Right.
So I'm going to argue this way. If we are to transform anything in our society, whether it's our industries, our communities, our state functions, we cannot overlook the role of young people. Because as Einstein said, you cannot expect new results, you know, by applying the same mindset over and over again. You're most probably going to end up getting the same result. And so the logic is to argue that the same generation that has been trying to solve climate change for all these years is still the same generation who gets to go home or gets the function of deciding what the solution may be for us. But I feel and I think for young people, we have the transformative ideas that are required to really look or leap leapfrog most of our economies, especially if you look into sectors like energy. There's a lot of young people on the ground coming up with frugal innovations that are actually giving alternative forms of electricity production, distribution, generation, and some type of innovation that comes with accessing for everybody, especially if you look at SDG 7 that argues for equitable access to new energy for alternative energy for everybody. However, I'm very much convinced that sometimes we as the youth don't realize that we are not here to do what has been done, but we are here to transform the society and bring our innovative and unique ideas to the table. Now, you ask the question, how can governments make sure that young people participate in that? I will argue that, one, they should not only listen to young people when they are in front of them. You need to listen to us even when we are not there. Go online, download reports, figure out what the young people within your country are doing, ask them to submit reports, include the ideas of young people. So you got to separate the 35 and below year old human being and the idea that they produce. Because just because I'm young does not mean my idea cannot be implemented. Sometimes the institutions will not listen to a young people because they come off very young, and therefore they assume that this person's idea is not something that we can look into. But the other idea that I also find weird is that most governments, especially when it comes to the UNFCCC reporting system, it's very strenuous on developing nations, because the amount of reports you have to submit from the NDC annually, every 5 years, to the global stock taking that we'll do in 2023, to the national communications, to the adaptation communications, all of these documents require a lot of time and effort. And often most governments don't have that resource. That's why if you look at the current negotiation around that issue, developing nations were mostly arguing for some type of leverage and system that allows them to report according to their capacity and not report everybody with a blanket expectation. So that's where the youth can come in. Because young people, for example, can help a lot of governments collect data around greenhouse gas emissions by sources and sinks. We are the ones who are actually on the ground that are understanding how the different institutions meet and the intersectional agendas as well. When you look at things, groups like gender, that's also another argument that's not fully integrated within the climate change scope. And I think they should stop looking at young people as a group that you can use to push a stubborn part of the process. You should also invite us. You should start, you should start including us. Stop inviting. We are not a bunch of high school kids who come there, read a little poetry piece, dance a bit, eat some food, and then we say we had the young people there. I think it's important to actually include the youth in the whole process from when the project is launched, so that when you commemorate that particular event, then the young people know exactly what we are commemorating. We know exactly what we are fighting for. And this is some of the things that are missing in the space that I've found. The pressure from the youth is so heavy that most of the times it leads to tokenization. It also leads to polarization of the youth group within the climate change agenda.
What a conversation that was with Dion Shakuze, youth advocate for sustainable development and climate change policy expert, all the way from Namibia. Dion is this very brilliant young man. His mind is bright, and the way he articulates his words and his thoughts inspires me a whole lot. Thank you so much, Dion. Really grateful. Really, really grateful. And to you who's been listening, thank you so much for your time. And guess what? This is just the first part of the conversation with Dion Shakuze. So in a few days from now, I'm going to make public the second episode of this conversation with Dion Shakuze. And on that episode, we talk more specifically about the recently launched United Nations Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change. And you really don't want to miss that. We also touch on some practical solutions that young people in Namibia are driving, as well as how we could advance the work of young people across the world and amplify the very great things that they do to solve climate change and to make this world a better place for you and for me. And that's about the size of the package on this episode of the Climate Talk podcast. I am not exhausted, but I have to go. I am Sheyi Fumi Adebote. I love it when you call me your green guide on this ride, and you can be sure that I will land you safely on the other side. Thank you again, Olumide Edowu and Jimoh Oluwatobi-Segun. Feel free to reach out to us, theclimatetalkpodcast.com. You will find our contact there. But if you have some exciting stories you want to share with me, or some exciting things happening around the world, around the environmental scene, and you want me to spotlight them on the Climate Talk podcast, I'm very happy to do that. Feel free to shoot me a mail, shei@climatetalkpodcast.com. That's spelled S-E-Y-I @climatetalkpodcast.com. And be sure that I will respond to your mails as soon as I can. And with these five words, I'll say goodbye. Keep taking climate actions.